Today, I've got my friend and colleague, Lauren Williams of Student Loan Planner, joining us today. How are you doing, Lauren?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you doing today, Trav?
Pretty good. So we are here to talk about your real estate nightmare. I'm joking around a little bit about that, but we had a team call recently, and well, tell me what you told us.
I just sold my house today. I was super excited. And it wasn't just because I sold the house, but it was like I had gotten a burden off my back that had become a 6-month complete nightmare. So I'd owned a house since 2004. In October, my renter started to act a little weird. I asked him to move out. He did move out. It took me from December to May. Now we're in June. Actually, I closed on June 1st. To get the house sold. So that took quite a while. That was months of paying him more. We're getting too much into the episode, but things did not go well initially. But if the house is off my hands, and I can't wait to tell you guys all the reasons I don't think you want to go into real estate.
Here's the thought for people that are super into real estate. We're going to cover your experience. We're going to talk real briefly about, you know, some resources that you can check out to get super involved with it. We're not at all saying that real estate and investing in real estate is a bad thing, right, Lauren? Right. We're simply just taking the other side of the coin a little bit to just put out a little bit of a caution out there, because a lot of what I see online in the personal finance community and in content creation space is like, everybody should be a landlord. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know about you, but like, I'm listening to a radio show and it's like, so-and-so is coming to St. Louis on August 15th to talk about my secret plan for how you can be a millionaire next month. All you have to do is sign up for my, am I doing a good impression? All you have to do is sign up for our limited workshop. The space is extremely limited. So call now.
it's only $3,000. Put it on your credit card at a 23% interest rate.
Whatever. Right. And then like I saw some sort of like Facebook post, and they literally showed this workshop where it was like 100 people packed in super tight. Obviously, this is pre-COVID, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody was packed in shoulder to shoulder, and they're at some like $80,000 house, and they're just showing them the secret. You know, buy this house, you can flip this house or rent this house. And a lot of real estate investing out there is dream selling. You know what I mean? Like, it's not really telling you about the pros and the cons and getting into the technical stuff and talking about IRRs or talking about free cash flow and all these different metrics when you're thinking about real estate, but it's kind of trying to sell a dream. You know, it's actually funny. I was thinking about working from home, like, you know, how like working from home scams are a big deal. I thought about it like work from home after this COVID pandemic. I feel like work from home scams are just going to go away because there's going to be zero demand, right? Everybody's like, work from home. Screw that. Like, I want to go to an office. Give me an office with coffee and boring desks. Like, yes. Like, get me out of this place.
Right.
Oh, man. So I don't want to get too sidetracked, but we're going to talk about some of the personal experiences, Lauren, you experienced on our own team as a highly informed person, certified financial planner being involved in real estate and why it didn't work out. And maybe some people that are on the fence about real estate that should not get involved with real estate will listen to this podcast and think, okay, good, I can kind of not do this. And people that listen to this and are still bound and determined to get involved with it, good. We pushed back a little bit on your dream, and now you're going to overcome that anyways because you're passionate enough to get involved with it. So those are some of my two cents.
I say that sums up, you know, the kind of point of today is that we want to give you the other side of the story and, you know, like I said, give you the information so that you can make a more educated decision, because I feel that we're kind of outnumbered as it pertains to messaging on, like you said, real estate being the best thing and everybody wanting passive income and like you said, commercials and all that. So it's not so much that you can't do this, it's that we want you to know what you're getting into if you decide to do this and to get the real life story of, you know, what happens behind the scenes if you don't do it right. Like you said, a certified financial planner was not a certified financial planner when I bought the house, you know, in full disclosure, but we're not perfect and we make financial mistakes too. And that's another thing that we want to drive home today is that when you make a mistake, it's important to understand it, realize it, and bail out so that you can continue to move forward, because holding on can also cost you a lot of money.
So let's just tell everybody the full story. What happened? Why did you buy the house? How did you decide to rent it? How did you decide it became a huge headache? Let's just hear the full story.
The long story short of the big house is I lived in it from 2006 until 2012. And then, you know, life happened. Things were changing. I decided to move out. At the last minute when I decided to move out, I decided I was going to actually stay in Miami. So I wanted to move back in, but I'd already rented my house. So I moved into a rental property and started renting my house. And that's kind of the beginning of me becoming a landlord. So, you know, I'll say full disclosure, I did not plan on becoming like a real estate investor. It wasn't that I, you know, did a lot of research on whether these properties were going to be profitable from an investment standpoint. These were houses that I planned on living in, and then life happened and things changed. So as of 2012, I moved out of that house, like I said, rented. And in 2017, I sold that house. So, like I said, the real estate crash was in 2006. 2017, I still had not recovered and ended up short selling that house.
So the short sell of the house, when was that? Was it the big house or the cheaper house?
So the big house, I ended up short selling in 2017. If you don't know a lot about short selling, that is you selling the house for less than you owe on the house. To do that so many years later was just kind of like a financial fail. You know, I retired from sport in 2013. So there was a period where I knew, you know, income wise, like I can't support this house. Even though I had renters in it, it was like, you know, if they move out, this is going to create financial stress and strain on me because I have another property. I'm now living somewhere else. This is just not a good idea if I can't keep renters in it. And so my light bulb was cut on to the fact that I don't necessarily want this thing hanging over my head, even though I'm kind of covered from a renter standpoint. But I held on for quite a while until I finally decided, okay, Lauren, you need to, and it was actually talking to a financial planner. So financial planners also need financial planners because they need someone that can be objective. I was holding on because I was like, the market's going to come back. I'm going to sell it for more than I bought it for. It's all going to be okay. And it's like, no, cut your losses, because I was covering the property taxes and the insurance out of my pocket every year. So the renters were just covering the mortgage. That's not a good investment. And that's what I was saying about understanding you're making a financial mistake and cutting your losses versus continuing to make the same mistake and potentially putting yourself in harm's way as it pertains to like really wrecking your finances.
So you made a mistake that a lot of people make, which is buying too much house for you to achieve your financial goals easily. Is that fair?
That hits the hammer on the head. And, you know, like I said, not only that, I didn't want to live in the house. I wanted to live in a completely different state. And, you know, it just would have put a lot of pressure on me to have to earn to keep the house in addition to, like you said, meet my other financial goals. It was like I was earning and I could, you know, I was making a decent living, but I wasn't making the same living that I was when I was participating in sports. So I needed to cut that loss and downsize. And I should have recognized that earlier on instead of kind of keep dumping money into that thing, hoping that I was going to somehow recoup losses.
You kind of casually mentioned the price tags. I think when you said 340 and 860, you're talking about 340,000. And 860,000. I mean, is that right?
Yep.
Wow. That's a huge mortgage, right? I mean, that's like a big payment. And you were in the top tax bracket when you were winning most of your medals, but then you retired, right? So like, what was that like going from having, you know, the income that you had to having a lot lower income when you retired from being a professional athlete?
Yeah, I think it's a really tough thing that a lot of people don't know or understand how to plan for. And I was really fortunate as an athlete, you know, so the average career of a professional athlete is 3 to 5 years. And the 5 years, you're pretty much on the lucky side of things. So I could have made a lot less money over my career. My career ended up being exactly 10 years long, you know, being a professional athlete, full-time earnings. And so I kind of beat the odds in that regard, but I didn't get 30 years of this kind of earnings, and I didn't know what I was going to do life after sport. And I think one of the mistakes that people who end up in situation, like you said, pro sports or anything else that has a short time frame on it, is not understanding I need to make the most of these dollars right now so that I can also create financial stability and financial freedom for myself in the future, because these earnings aren't going to last forever. And that's the kind of conversations I'm having with my clients now. You know, they're 20, they're fresh into the sport, and you know, they think they're invincible. Nothing can stop them. And we're planning for 3 to 5 years. You know, you're lucky. And also, what do you want to do life after sport? And they're just like, but I'm just getting started. And I'm like, but we need to know, because you need to understand that if you're earning $300,000 now and you have only your undergraduate degree and no experience, you might be making $40,000 when you're done. So we need to be able to plan to supplement your income. If you want to live on a, you know, let's say $60,000 income, we want to make sure we have enough saved up so that you can kind of do that. or we need to be planning for starting with a $40,000 income right now, even though you're making $300,000. So those are the kind of conversations that someone needs to have with someone that's young, doesn't have a lot of financial literacy, you know, just doesn't have a lot of experience in the world in general around why it may or may not be a good idea to purchase. The other conversation I have is, do you plan on moving in the near future? So a lot of people like to get in the house and they just feel like it's the grown-up thing to do. Everybody uses this kind of cliche term, I'm throwing away money on rent. But if you're going to be moving in the 3 to 5 years of actually purchasing the house, chances are you're not going to be selling and having made any money on that house. So I talked to them about that as well. And as athletes, sometimes you need to pick up and leave and go to a different coach. So now you bought a house in one state and next year you're moving to another state to be with your coach. Now you got to be a landlord or put your house on the market. So you're either locking in losses for the most part, or you're committing to be a landlord from afar and taking on the extra expense of a property manager or managing it yourself, which can be quite a bit of a headache. So those are conversations that I think are important to have when you're thinking about purchasing real estate.
Well, I mean, that happens too with people that are in medical training or in residency or fellowship, right? I mean, your husband is a physician. So, you know, I know, and I'm married to a physician. So, you know, we kind of know the medical kind of world, but we see people that are, you know, want to buy a house in residency, right? Then they transfer to a different city for fellowship and they have a property manager managing their house when they're in the original place, right? And then they move from a different place from fellowship to attending life. And, you know, it's just, I guess, tell me about, is real estate, is it truly passive? What do you think about people say, get some passive income and buy a real estate property? What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that there's very, very little that's passive about real estate. I'd love to hear the true passivity, or is that even a word, of how it is. So like I said, my experience was something broke. So that's one thing, is I did not hire a property manager. You know, it was a cheapo. It's the same thing, like, you know, I feel about people not hiring us for student loans or people not hiring, you know, me as a financial planner. Like, I can do this on my own. What is it going to cost you to do this thing on your own? And what are the mistakes that you may make from not being an expert on this going to cost you from doing it on your own? I made all the mistakes by not enlisting the help of someone else. Like I said, I had the renters. I didn't have a property manager. So every time something was breaking, I had to figure that out. So I was calling back and forth. Luckily, my mom moved to Florida somewhere in the process. So sometimes she would go down or she would call an AC guy to fix something, or, you know, a hurricane came and I had to get roof repairs. She kind of snuck in and, you know, helped me out as a property manager. But, you know, that was not her area of expertise either. And it was a lot to manage and it was disruptive to, you know, my life in Texas every time something happened to the properties in Florida. So that was one thing, is, you know, just actually managing the house. So that's not passive at all. It takes time. It takes effort. It takes money. A lot of people, this is the other thing as I see, is that you think about what your mortgage is going to be. They forget to calculate what property taxes and insurance is going to be if it's separate. Sometimes your property tax and insurance will be included in the overall payment, so you know what that looks like on a monthly basis. But sometimes it's not. But is your renter actually going to cover mortgage, property tax, and insurance, and there still be something left over? Or, and they're also going to cover, like you said, any like maintenance fees or something like that that you may have. You know, you may be paying PMI on a mortgage if you did a really low down payment, which is what a lot of real estate investors do, is, you know, put as little of their own skin in the game. So, you know, what is there really left over after everything is taken care of on a monthly basis? And it may be 100 or 200 bucks. So now we got 100 or 200 bucks. Let's call it 200 times 12. You made 2,400 bucks that year as the profit. But then the washing machine breaks. Well, there you go.
Gone.
Yeah.
So I've actually seen a really interesting statistic that I am stealing from this website called Millennial Revolution. They're really a great couple that's thought leaders in the financial independence community. And they say that you want to take the monthly payment that you're paying for a house and then multiply that by 1.4. So in other words, say your mortgage, you do the mortgage and the mortgage is $1,000 with everything included, you know, property taxes, insurance, all of it. That's equivalent financially in terms of like the smart financial decision making. That's equivalent to renting a place 1.4 times as expensive. In other words, $1,400 a month. That's an equivalent financial decision to owning a house that's $1,000 a month. So most people make the decision, Lauren, in my experience at least, they will say, oh, I can get a mortgage for less than I can rent this place.
I hear it all the time.
All the time, right? And what do you say about that, you know, when, you know, you're comparing a mortgage payment to a rental payment? What are people not thinking about?
Well, maintenance, things I just talked about. So something breaks in the house. You're not thinking about lawn maintenance. You're not thinking about AC filters. You know, you want to move in and decorate the place. You want to take out a wall. You want to renovate. Everything that falls apart in the house is up to you to get fixed, in addition to keeping it looking nice, preventing wear and tear so that your investment, quote unquote, can continue to appreciate. So, you know, I'll pause and say that was one of the things that happened with the house that the smaller house that I just sold was I had renters in there for 8 years. And like I said, so I bought it in 2004. We're 19 years down the road? That's bad math, right?
16
years. There we go.
All right. Yeah.
Help me out, Jeff.
You're forgiven because, I mean, what day is it? I don't know.
Right.
What month is it?
COVID, pandemic, life. Yeah.
Yeah.
2020 problems, we'll just call them. But yeah, so 16 years I lived, I had that house. I lived in the house for 2 years. My mom lived in it for a couple years, and then I had renters for 8 years. Over that time period when I was living in it, of course, I wanted to fix it up. So I put in new laminate floors. You know, I bought a new refrigerator, but it's still been 16 years. I had 8 years of renters, and very seldom did the renters call me. So I said something else I didn't do. I didn't check regularly. Want to know why I didn't check regularly? Because I was living in another state. So I had no property manager. I was not checking regularly. They were, you know, upstanding citizens, gainfully employed. Rent was paid on time. So I didn't really feel like I needed to check regularly. I figured if something was wrong, they would let me know. But what happened? 15 years passed or 16 years and the house had no updates. So now I'm selling a house that has, you know, the same laminate floors from 14 years ago that just, you know, regular wear and tear. I don't think that they did anything negligent or bad. They need to be replaced, though. They don't look good. The paint doesn't look good. The two big whammies that made this house really, really unproductive for me, I needed a roof in order to be able to list the house. So my option was to either get a new roof if I wanted to sell so that I would have access to people who needed a mortgage, or to not get a new roof and only take cash offers. Well, we know that cash offers are a lot less because that's where flippers come in.
Right.
And I actually got a few offers from flippers. So I started also, I'll tell you, $375 was, like I said, what I bought the house for. $480 is what I listed the house for based on what I thought were the comparables. One, you got to know what the market is doing. And two, I realized, you know, a little bit later that, you know, with no updates, people just did not want the hassle of the house. And I had a big lot. So I thought that that was going to still kind of warrant me getting a higher price. I ended up selling at $420 plus my roof that I had to get done before. So that was $18,000. Oh, I didn't tell you guys, like I said, I had a renter in there. The rent was about $2,500. That made me break even. So people like to avoid the numbers. I feel like it's important to give you guys kind of the numbers behind the scenes because it's important to understand like how was all this unfolding. So his rent was $2,500 a month. My mortgage was $14,000 and property taxes and insurance was not included. So between the two of those things, it ended up being around $1,000. So basically, I think it came out to like $2,300 was mortgage, property tax, insurance. He's giving me $25. It's literally that situation I was just telling you where I was making $200 a month if nothing went wrong.
Well, but let's pause there for a second. So let's do some math. You made $25,000, Lauren, like, because you said $420 minus the $18,000 for the air conditioning. So that's like $20,000. And then you paid down the mortgage, right? So you paid down half of that $375,000 mortgage and you got $20,000 of appreciation. And I'm playing a little bit of I'm being a little facetious here, but didn't you get half of the mortgage? So that's like $190 plus the $20,000 of appreciation. So that's like, didn't you make like a $200,000 profit, Lauren?
Woo, that sounds awesome, Trav. Wouldn't it be nice if? Well, I also had to pay the realtor 6%, so 3% to each realtor that was involved. We didn't get to all the maintenance and fees that happened. So I also had to buy a $7,000 air conditioning. So the air conditioning died right before the renter moved out. So that wasn't optional. You know, I couldn't wait and maybe, you know, mark the house down because the renter was still in there. So he couldn't be in Florida with no AC. So $7,000 for a new AC. Like I said, I mentioned kind of at the beginning that we didn't move out on good terms. So after 8 years of everything going great, the renter kind of went haywire, for lack of a better term, and moved out kind of abruptly, left my house in a, like, there was blood, there was feces, there was like it. You would have thought Section 8 housing. Like I said, after I just previously told you, like, gainfully employed, nice people, had always been normal. Something happened in his life that I don't know, but it did not end up well. So it cost $800 to get his stuff onto the curb. It cost $500 for someone to clean the house. So we're talking 1,100 square foot house. So you got to imagine how dirty a house was when someone charges you $500 to clean it.
Blood and feces, like, shoot, I'm surprised it wasn't like $3,000. Like, you have to bring in like a hazmat suit or something. Like,
exactly. Yeah. When they told me $500, I didn't bat an eye. I was like, okay, great. When
do you come? When do you start? Yeah. Wow. What about transfer taxes? I mean, is that a thing in Florida?
No transfer taxes. What are transfer taxes?
Well, like some states, you have to pay a percentage or something like that. Maybe it's 1% or 2% of like the property's value to do like a title transfer.
Yes, it wasn't referred to as transfer taxes, but that is, yeah, that was an expense as well.
Yeah, I mean, because you have to pay a certain percentage in fees to the government to, when you sell real estate in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a lot of expenses. So how much of the mortgage did you pay down over those 16 years?
It was pretty close to half. I mean, the other thing you didn't factor into the overall, like you said, what I brought home is that I put 20% down. So
sure.
We're talking 375. What did I put down? Mathematician on that side.
80K or something like that.
Right, exactly. So that's money that, you know, just return of, you know, initial down payment.
What did you actually take home after the proceeds? Like, because a lot of people will say, oh, well, a home is like, you're having somebody else pay your mortgage for you, right? So the mortgage is getting paid off over time and you eventually own an asset that you can sell for some sort of positive amount of money.
Right.
What I'm saying is so you invested, if you want to think about it as an investment, you invested $80,000,
mm-hmm.
and then you had years worth of work, labor that you had to do versus be it you or your mom who did all this work to facilitate owning the place. And you had expenses basically that barely covered the mortgage. And then you had all of this maintenance expenses. So over the 16 years, like how much do you think you spent on maintenance expenses?
Yeah, I would say I spent at least $2,000 a year on maintenance expenses. So I know that $200 a month was eaten up. Hurricane would come. I needed to pay someone to put up shutters. That AC broke quite a few times and ended up like right before he moved out that I bought a whole new one. But frequent AC repairs, it was a thing as well. I said from time to time, there were just little things that needed to be replaced. And I would say at least spent $2,000. Like I said, they were in the house for 8 years. So if I paid a mortgage for 2 years, 2004 to 2006, let's call it 2008. Because like I said, I had some people living there that were kind of half paying mortgage. So my mortgage was getting paid whether or not they paid me. Sometimes they were not paying me. So yeah, we got to take that out as well. And then I had the 8 years of, like you said, someone quote unquote paying my mortgage. So what I ended up bringing home after, like you said, I brought home like two something, like you said, and then I ended up with 150. So all expenses that needed to be covered related to this house, related to whatever has happened over the course of time, I'm left with 150. But then, like you said, what about all the money I came out of pocket? And unfortunately, I don't have the math on that, but I would say that would definitely, over the course, you know, 15 years, be at least another 50K of this 150 that we're talking. And then we can take out the 80K. So I think nothing's left at this point.
I'm actually trying to do some math real quick on our podcast on the live show.
Right. Woo. You're a spreadsheet guru, so you can just throw this in somewhere.
Okay. So if you take the 80,000 and then down payment or approximated, you know, and you throw in the 20 grand for the roof, like $2,000 a year for maintenance or so, you throw in, that's over 16 years, $2,000 a year for maintenance times 16. So the roof is 20K. The maintenance is 32,000 over 16 years. The realtor fee is about 25 grand. Title transfer tax is probably like 5,000. And then miscellaneous closing kind of costs and things like that's maybe about 5,000. If you look at,
don't forget my $7,000 AC.
Oh, shoot. Well, I'll put that in there. Okay, so that's 174,000 of contributed capital over those 16 years. So the amount of money you got out, let's say it was about 200,000. Some people would look at that as, oh, you made a $30,000 gain, right? But if you look at the fact that it was over a 16-year period, the rate of return on that money over those 16 years is 0.8%, which is lower than what you would have gotten if you put the money in the bank that you'd contributed to the house and just rented a place instead.
Exactly.
You know? So, I mean, I really understand, you know, talking to you about why you're so happy to be rid of this stupid thing. But the thing is people make these mistakes, these math mental mistakes before they're super informed about finances all the time. right? Mm-hmm. Like your experiences was not at all an unusual experience. And furthermore, it was an experience that we see gazillions of people who are not finance people make, especially early on in their career, because a home is the best investment there is, right? They're not making any more land, Lauren.
Right.
I guess the thing is you have to think about it like a business. If you thought about it like a business, then I think the smart decision would have been to do maybe a short sale at some point, kind of like the other house, or just to cut your losses, right? And just try to walk away before you've experienced so many years worth of pain and heartache dealing with this house. But people don't like that. So can we talk about cognitive biases for a second? So in terms of you not hiring a property manager, I guess my guess is the reason that you didn't hire one is because there wasn't enough money available in the rent to pay them and pay the mortgage and not have a negative cash flow. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that would about sum it up. And it's just like, well, it should be easy. That, like, I can set the rent and it shows up in my account. And what else do I really need until, you know, all these different things start to happen? And then you realize what you would need and, you know, why it would benefit you from having someone else to have to deal with that headache versus you.
Right. So I guess there's a lesson. If you can't afford a property manager to have positive cash flow, that's a sign that you need to get out of the house.
Yep.
That seems like a good kind of rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other reason is, and I'll use my own parents for an example. So I don't think they really listen to the podcast too often. So I'm gambling here, but they owned rental real estate. They owned a house. And the thing is they always managed it themselves. And I'm pretty sure that if you calculate all the hours they spent and calculated it minimum wage, probably the return in their rental house is probably negative when you include the time of their labor. Mm-hmm. And it's because we as individuals, a lot of times will think in terms of again, cost versus value. Business people that are successful think in terms of value. People that are just sort of like, I guess, normal people sometimes think in cost. And they're very different things. Like for an example, with my parents, like if they had hired a property manager, they could have scaled beyond one property because they don't have unlimited time. So that's thinking about real estate like a business versus as something that you just do because it seems like it makes sense to do. I guess for my parents, I feel like a big reason why they didn't hire a property manager was maybe pride. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to spend money on that. I can do that job myself.
Yeah. Right? Which is the same reason people get into real estate. You know, when we ask people about why they're interested in real estate, it's because people understand that you can purchase a house. They see other people do it. They're like, oh, I know somebody else that doesn't make as much as me, or, you know, I don't feel like it's as smart as me. And it's like, I can definitely do it. It seems very attainable. Whereas like, it's like the big creepy stock market that I don't understand. And you got to be a registered investment advisor and have all this knowledge and expertise. And so it makes them feel like, oh, like this thing is something that I can do because everyone else is doing it. And, you know, I have XYZ reasons that I can become, you know, it makes sense. It's going to appreciate and I'm going to make money. And it's just that simple, but they don't think about the complexities of it all.
So as a CFP, what do you tell people that want income from alternative sources? Like, why do people love alternative income strategies so much?
Like you said, part of it is the marketing aspect of it. The other part of it is that people don't understand the market, a lot of mistrust in the market. So like I said, my clients are in their 20s and 30s. And those of us that are in our 30s, you know, experienced 2008. You know, they saw their parents kind of freaking out during that time, even though they were a little bit younger. You know, there's a little bit of a burn ingrained in them about what happens when the market crashes and, you know, the chaos that ensues. And what if this happens to me? And I'd much rather have my money in like a physical house, because even if 2008 happens, I still have like a physical building. But like you said, the thing they're not thinking about is, like you said, the housing market also crashed. And so when I think of an alternative investments, I think about fear around investing because of lack of education. And the market is not some big, bad, scary thing. I think, you know, you even created an investing course to help people not feel so intimidated by the market, because it's something that you can do. And there's a lot of robo-advisors out there. We frequently tell people, like, try Betterment. Like, you click your name, address, or your name, what are you trying to do? What are you trying to accomplish? What date? And, you know, it does everything for you, and it's low cost. So you don't need to be an investment guru to join the the investment market, and you can also do real estate. That would be my one big thing. And you know what I'm actually going to do with some of the money that's left over? I'm going to buy REIT ETF. You know, I still got real estate in my portfolio. I'm still diversified. That's another thing I hear people say about alternative investments is, you know, I don't want everything in the market. I got to diversify. And so real estate is a way for me to be able to diversify. Like I said, I'm going to buy a REIT ETF. I'm not buying any more real estate.
And so, for example, VNQ, the Vanguard REIT ETF, what they do is they go buy shares of residential property, a commercial property, and they take care of all the property management. You pay a fee basically to own that and have them manage that. Now that fee at Vanguard is like 0.1% or something like that, right? It's very, very low. And the thing is, you know, investing in a real estate ETF, that's not necessarily something that we're going to say is suitable or something that you should do on this podcast, because this is for your entertainment, right? We're not your financial advisor. So we have to throw that disclosure out there. So we're not telling you go buy that ETF. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that that's a conversation that you have with a financial advisor, like, oh, you want to own real estate? Let's talk about that. Pros and cons, direct ownership versus passive ownership of ETFs or mutual funds. So there's multiple ways to skin a cat. And a lot of people think the only way is I can go be a landlord and I'm going to cut, you know, the grass for my tenants. And like, that's the thing that just blew me away. My mom and dad would put in the contract for their tenants that they were going to do all the lawn upkeep.
Yikes. They are much
and
better.
I'm like, first of all, can I rent from you? Will you mow my grass for free? What in the world? That's not like a standard contract. Like, I don't know of anybody that like mows their tenants' grass.
Yeah.
Again, it's just like, I love my parents. Like, I'm so grateful that they did so many good things with their finances, including having a high savings rate. So that's one reason why I'm so like, savings rate, savings rate, savings rate. Like, I just can't say it over and over again, because my parents' savings rate was really good, and that papered over every single mistake they ever made financially.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a ton of mistakes if you have a good savings rate. If you don't have a good savings rate, goodness, you can really get in trouble in a hurry. And sometimes we have these conversations with like medical professionals, like somebody who's like a surgeon and they have private practice ownership aspirations, or maybe they have thought about it and they're like, I want to flip a bunch of houses. Okay, so you're going to compete against hedge funds, people who only do that, whereas you have to have a full-time job, you know, in something that takes a lot of your mental energy. And then also, by the way, you know, maybe you could own a private practice or a surgical center where, you know, instead of tons of extremely talented people competing with you, you're competing against your local hospital system and a couple other people in your geographic area.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Warren Buffett talks about having a moat. People want to have all this passive income because I think they want to get excited. Like, sometimes I think people get bored. It's like, I've done enough fillings this month. I want to do something different. Like, it's kind of like my wife, like she's a physician and she's like, I want to be a journalist. Like, I want to get paid to write journalistic pieces. I think sometimes people just get so excited by making income from something that's not what they're used to. It's just like, human beings love new, right? Like, you love something different and exciting and new and it's unknown. You know what I mean, Lauren? Like, people like the different.
What do you think about these like seven streams of income? Because I think that's what you said. Some of it is the marketing of it all. So they're excited by something new. And it's like you said, diversify. So I feel like a lot of the financial mistakes that are made are based on kind of the trendy cliche things that are, like you said, I hear all the time, I want passive income. I hear all the time, you know, I'm doing the employer match and that's super cool. All the time, I want a Roth. People don't know why they want a Roth. They want a Roth because everybody's getting a Roth. They're doing the employer match because everyone's doing the employer match. I frequently have to explain to people that the employer match is not enough. 3-6% of your income is not going to get you to where you need to be for retirement. You can get $19,000 in that 401k. So what do you think about the kind of cliche or the common trendy thing that people talk about? You need seven streams of income.
It's a social pressure thing, right? It's like social media, like hashtag blessed living. You know what I mean? People say things because they sound good. But for me, you know, we have three streams of income. One stream of income is my wife's job, which is medical and not really that related to what I do. One stream of my income is my business. And then our third stream of income is our investments, basically our passive index fund type investments. I guess technically, Lauren, I would be a little lying if I didn't say we had more than three, because I have my $0.99 ebook, 25 is the new 65, about when I retired at 25. That pays me a stunning $6 approximately every quarter. So I actually have multiple streams of income, Lauren. With streams of income, do you want 7 streams that are an inch wide, or do you want the Mississippi River? That's kind of a weird like analogy, I guess. For somebody who's looking at growing their income, if you focus on one thing and try to be the best in the world at it, you can grow that income enormously and make a ton of money to get to a target net worth that once you get to that net worth, you're so financially independent that you don't have to worry about anything. Everything above that level is gravy. So for me, like my thought process is find one stream of income that you love and then try to grow that stream of income to be a mile wide versus trying to spread yourself so thin, trying to do a little bit of this, a little bit of that. That to me is a recipe for mediocrity with income growth. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you could really kind of get a you know, jet fuel rocket launch type of income growth, that to me is finding something you're passionate about. So that's where we get into people who should own real estate. If you want to own 10 properties or more, get involved in real estate. If you want to have a system involved, or if you live in Excel spreadsheets and just love the idea of reading real estate books for fun, you know, you listen to real estate podcasts in the gym for fun, then get involved in real estate. But it's kind of like the same thing that we tell people when they're thinking about joining the military for student loan forgiveness benefits. We tell people that's a terrible idea unless you want to serve. If you want to serve, join the military and take advantage of this benefit that happens to exist for student loan forgiveness or student loan repayment benefits. It's like PSLF. We tell people all the time, if you don't want to do a not-for-profit job or government job and you're doing it mainly because of PSLF, oh my gosh, are you making the wrong decision? That's not a financially justifiable decision to do it just for loan forgiveness, to do something that you don't want to do. So, I mean, I don't know. I'm just kind of, I know I'm preaching to the choir a little bit, but it kind of seems to me like, you know, people need to be a little bit more cognizant about what kind of thing they enjoy doing to really grow their income.
Yeah. You don't want to do it because everybody else is doing it and because, oh, it seems like you said, it seems accessible and I want to jump in it. You want to do it because investing the time in it to get that return on it is not going to be something that's going to make you completely miserable. And I think, like you said, a lot of what's being sold is that it's so easy, a caveman can do it sort of thing. So I'm just going to go out here and do it and it's going to be no sweat off my back in addition to my regular job. That's what we're trying to warn people against, is that it's not so easy, a caveman can do it. And if you're really willing to invest the time, you can be profitable. And like you said, when I think about ways that I've seen people be successful, it is like multifamily homes. Or, you know, paying cash for a property and, you know, not having to worry about the mortgage and the insurance. Well, you still have to pay the insurance, but not having so many expenses associated with the big expense being the mortgage, that's out of the way. So now I can focus on how I'm going to earn a return on X number of dollars that I put into this thing.
Right.
Once again, that goes back to savings rate. How do you save up to pay cash for a house, or you buy something that's really small, or, you know, what are my options as it pertains to those things?
Or at least have a big down payment where you're cash flow positive. Two suggestions. If you are interested in real estate, and obviously you're listening to this podcast, so you might listen to more podcasts. So check out the Coach Carson podcast and check out the Bigger Pockets podcast. Both of those are real estate specific and really are not the hyped up real estate kind of things. They're really legitimate. How do you succeed in real estate as somebody who's passionate about it? So invest the time and resources. The other thing is, there's rules like the 1% rule, where it basically says, if you can find a house that will rent for 1% of the purchase price per month, then that might be a good house to own. The problem is that rule's harder to find as more and more kind of big hedge funds and private equity get involved in the real estate space and owning even residential mortgages and residential properties. And that's what you're competing against. And so that's why you have to be super invested in learning about this stuff and really enjoy it, because you're going to have to do a lot of work to buy a bunch of properties to provide that level of passive income. I will say this, though. One of my favorite college players, I went to the University of Florida when Tim Tebow and Percy Harvin and those folks were playing there. And so Percy Harvin is one of my favorite players. He went to the Minnesota Vikings and Seahawks, and he had a cool strategy where he just took his earnings and bought a bunch of rental properties in cash. He did that because that made him feel comfortable. He understood those investments. He could hold on to those investments long term and not sell them and panic, because, you know, you don't get somebody calling you up telling you your rental price fell. And then he gets free cash flow that he can spend after property manager manages it that will cover his expenses for the rest of his life. That is a wonderful way to think about real estate if you had a windfall or you have the opportunity to pay off your mortgage or something like that. You know, do that, sure. Limit leverage. I mean, unless you really have invested the time, right? Like the low down payment mortgages, that's a real good way to blow yourself up. Your experience, Lauren, was a accidental landlord experience, right?
Right.
Just because you are a excited landlord, you know you're going to become a landlord, that doesn't protect you from what Lauren went through, right, Lauren? Like, you know, you did something that felt right in the moment, owning a house, excited about your achievements and having the level of income that you had, and then something unexpected happened. And that's usually how these problems pop up, right?
Exactly.
Nobody knew that the Great Recession was coming, and then it happened. And then people that had low leverage would have been okay. People that have high leverage, it's just so painful. It's just difficult to get out of that hole. So in terms of real estate, did I say that right, Lauren? Like, what would you add to that?
I feel like you nailed it, Trav. And, you know, that's kind of exactly what the advice would be. Like you said, you can get a huge down payment in there. And you know, like I said, the reason people usually cite and wanting to get into real estate from an investing standpoint is passive income. Well, the easiest way to create that passive income is, like you said, you're cash flow positive right out the gate because you put a big down payment. So it all leads back to having a sound financial foundation, being able to set aside money to save, which means you have some source of income that is allowing you to create the savings to begin the real estate investing in the first place. We always drive home as we do our student loan consults. You know, people frequently call us and say, student loans are ruining their lives and they're not allowing them to save and they're not allowing them to, you know, when they want to purchase a home, they want to do all these different things. And as we walk you through the student loan consult, we show you how putting more money into your 401k, it can actually lower your student loan payment. We show you how, you know, prioritizing saving and saying, I'm going to put this much money aside, period. And when I get my check, I'm going to do that first. And then everything else is going to come next. I'm going to live within my means based on what's left over, is how you create a recipe for success. So frequently people, you know, pay all the bills, all these people lined up, and I feel all the pressure of, you know, I got the rent, I got this, I got that, I got that. And whatever's left over is what's going to be my ability to save. And that never really, that doesn't frequently allow people to reach their savings goals and to be able to save for the future in the way they want to. Prioritizing saving is kind of the message that keeps coming up continuously, whether it's real estate investing or just working toward financial freedom.
And again, it's like, find your one source of income that gets you so excited that you want to turn it into the Mississippi River. And I'm saying Mississippi River because I live in St. Louis and the giant Mississippi River passes by our city, right? So that's kind of the river that's giant that's on my mind. So if you become dedicated to real estate, you're going to learn things about reducing your adjusted gross income. You'll learn about tax sheltering. You'll learn about 1031 exchanges when you want to sell one property and buy another without paying capital gains taxes. And you might learn how to pass along generational wealth to your kids to give them something to get started. Because when you pass away, you get stepped up in basis for appreciated investments generally. Mm-hmm. And you might be able to get to pass that along tax-free to your kids, which is a great way to build wealth. So, I mean, I think that there's a wonderful place for real estate for people that should invest in it. So, you know, if you're still interested in real estate by the end of this podcast, then you're interested enough to get involved in it, right? If you have listened to this and been like, oh my gosh, Lauren's experience, blood and feces in the rental house, like, I'm out of here, right? Like, stay away from it. And just remember that if you find a house with a low monthly payment that you're looking at buying, again, like, multiply that total mortgage payment by 1.4 and say, could I find a rental for like that or less that I like equally? And if the answer is yes, then you probably should rent instead of buy a house. Like, buying a house is something you want to do cautiously, not just jumping straight into it. So a couple more resources. PassiveIncomeMD.com is a friend of mine that has a good website for people that are trying to get more passive income from real estate that are willing to spend the time. Also, SemiRetiredMD.com has some novel strategies around reducing taxable income with real estate investments. So there's definitely things that you can get involved with in this space, but remember that the just simple basic investing in your 401k and then outside your 401k with index funds is a fantastic way for probably 90% of people to build the wealth they need to achieve their financial dreams. Anything to add to that, Lauren?
I think you drove home all the good points. I'm going to do the simple investing way from here on out.
Yeah, it's just the way that at least you can just do it, forget about it, and enjoy your life. And remember, investing at the end of the day, right? It's just a way to live the life that you want to live. If you're stressing yourself out, it's not worth it.
Exactly.
So I'm so glad, Lauren, that you are free of that anvil around your neck. And congratulations.
Thanks so much.
So thank you, everyone, for listening to today's show. If you have any questions, just hit us up. studentloanplanner.com/voicemail if you want to leave a question. And, you know, if you need a long-term plan for your student loans, hit us up.